the Arctic.
They have to stretch what they have. That means somewhere in the country, we're pulling something in order to do work up here, which is a growing area. So we know we need to add additional assets and equipment and staging capacity for the Coast Guard.
Ostebo moves to Washington soon to become deputy commandant for mission support. Some Alaska salmon are still getting Marine Stewardship Council certification for sustainability. KDLG's Mike Mason tells us more.
The Marine Stewardship Council's latest certification of Alaska's salmon fisheries as sustainable was made back in November, and it's in effect until November of 2018. However, the Purse Seine Vessel Owners Association has given way to the Alaska Salmon Processors Association. The new association's president is a Seattle lawyer who also serves as a director for Silver Bay Seafoods. Silver Bay Seafoods is just one of six companies allowed to use the highly regarded MSC sustainability label. Other client group members include Ecoc Fisheries, Copper River Seafoods, 10th and M Seafoods, E.C. Phillips & Son, and International Seafoods of Alaska. Most of the major seafood processors in Alaska rejected the MSC label in favor of the RFM sustainability label spearheaded by the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And I'm Steve Heimel.
Support for news on APRN is provided by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
This is APRN.
This is the Alaska Economic Report. The price of Brent crude oil is over $110 a barrel again this morning. A measure before the Sea Alaska Native Corporation shareholders could alter the way board elections are held, and that could bring leadership changes. The measure comes as 13 shareholders compete for four board seats in Sea Alaska's annual election. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
The measure is a resolution proposing limits to what's called discretionary voting. That's an option on Sea Alaska's proxy ballot, which lists candidates for the board of directors. When shareholders check a box, they give the board the power to cast their ballots for whomever they see fit. And the board votes for its slate of incumbents seeking re-election.
It's an unfair document because of the discretionary voting, and that is what has kept all our directors in all these years.
Mick Beasley is a Juneau Carver who's campaigned against discretionary voting. He's also one of this year's six independent board candidates. He authored the resolution that would largely eliminate discretionary voting. Without it, shareholders would pick and choose from the full list of candidates, including incumbents and their challengers.
If this resolution passes and we amend our bylaws, it'll make it equal voting rights for all shareholders.
They would wipe out what Sea Alaska believes would otherwise be a valid vote.
Nicole Hollingstad is Sea Alaska's communications vice president as well as corporate secretary. She and the board oppose Beasley's measure.
Those shareholders understand exactly what discretionary voting means, are offering their shares in support of the corporation, and that to remove that discretionary voting option would remove a choice that at least a quarter of our shareholders select on a regular basis.
The resolution does not completely eliminate discretionary voting. Beasley says it would be allowed when an independent group challenges the board and issues its own ballot.
If there are two slates, two proxies, then discretionary voting is fair game. When there is only one proxy, and that's Sea Alaska putting the proxy out, they cannot use discretionary voting unless there's another proxy that comes out.
Shareholders are rarely faced with two slates and proxies, but this year they are. A group calling itself Four Shareholders for Sea Alaska has sent out its own ballot and posted it online. The four top vote-getters will win three-year terms on the 13-member board. Results will be announced at Sea Alaska's annual meeting June 28th in Seattle. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Yesterday, ExxonMobil signed another Arctic offshore oil and gas exploration agreement with Russian national energy company Rosneft. Exxon development head Neil Duffin met with Rosneft CEO Igor Sechin in St. Petersburg despite the embargo over Russia's conduct in the Ukraine. I'm Steve Heimel.
The Alaska Economic Report is made possible by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
And this is KRBD. It's 8:14. Time to check in with Calvin at the Ketchikan Job Center. Calvin? All right, we'll hold a minute.
Good morning. This is Calvin Trout with the Ketchikan Job Center with today's report. The first position we have today is for a program assistant. This is for senior in the disability services. This employer is looking for a positive, detail-oriented person to fill the position of program assistant for, again, senior and disability services. Must be proficient in typing, computers, and various software, who will be responsible for completing data entry, filing, billing, documentation, organization, and other program support tasks. Proficiency with typing on computers, demonstrated attention to detail, and ability to manage complex tasks and work independently. This is a part-time position, open until filled, and the pay is $13.80 to $14.53 an hour, depending on experience. And we have a front desk person. This is a part-time, accommodate hotel patrons by registering and assigning rooms to guests, issuing room keys or cards, transmitting and receiving messages, keeping records of occupied rooms and guest accounts, making and confirming reservations, and presenting statements to and collecting payments from departing guests. And the pay on this position is, again, depending on experience, and $10 to $11 an hour. Our next listing is for a maintenance record keeper. The pay on this position is depending on experience. The applicant must have experience with Excel and be able to pass a pre-employment drug test and random drug testing. A valid driver's license is required. This position requires the applicant to be able to keep track of airplane parts through data entry and record keeping. The employer is willing to train the right person, and again, this position is depending on experience. And we have a job listing for a sandwich artist. This pay is $8 to $10 per hour, depending on experience. The employer is looking for someone who can provide good customer service, who is neat and clean per employer's grooming standards. Duties, food preparation or making sandwiches and cutting up vegetables, will bake and operate ovens. Positions are available at both locations, downtown and at Walmart. Thank you for listening today. These job announcements are brought to you by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, KRBD. Serving you at the Ketchikan Job Center, we are located at 2030 Sea Level Drive, Suite 220. Our office hours are Monday through Friday from 8 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. To check all these job announcements, you can visit our website, and that's www.jobs.alaska.gov. Remember, where people and jobs connect is the Ketchikan Job Center. Have a great day. And from the staff of the Ketchikan Job Center, we would like to thank all our veterans for their service. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Calvin.
Support for this program is provided by Madison True Value Lumber and Hardware, featuring True Value Easy Care Interior Paint, available in a variety of finishes and over 2,000 colors. Madison True Value Lumber and Hardware. True Value. Start right. Start here.
Support for this program comes from Full Circle, delivering a wide variety of organic farm fresh produce and groceries to pickup locations throughout Southeast Alaska. More information at fullcircle.com/SEAK. Full Circle, proud to support public radio in Southeast Alaska.
Sinudang Heidang.
Wasa Eyati.
Amplasha Dishnoon.
Greetings.
Welcome to Our Voices Will Be Heard Once Again on This Land, a tutorial in the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian languages. This week, we will be learning types of weather in the Tsimshian language. Today, we will learn how to say, the weather is snowy. Ya madam willowal laha. Ya madam willowal laha. Ya madam willowal laha.
You can continue practicing the phrases you've heard today by going to the KRBD website, krbd.org. For more information about Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian language classes, go to kictribe.org or call 228-5150. This program is a collaborative effort between KIC and KRBD.
Ndoyakshin.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. In summer, flowers add their color to the Arctic tundra. Monkshood, lousewort, avens, and willow catkins bloom and begin receiving visitors, nectar-sipping pollinators. Important among them is the fuzzy and colorful Arctic bumblebee, the queen of beasts among the tundra flowers. Big and hairy and social by nature, Bombus polaris is exquisitely adapted to life in the north. The Arctic bumblebee's ability to fly at low temperatures and for long distances makes them particularly important pollinators. One fat bee crawls from a purple monk's hood blossom and heads to the next patch of flowers. She emerged from hibernation in May as the tundra began warming. She spent 9 months in a subterranean burrow, already mated last fall. This queen is the sole survivor of her colony and has a busy summer ahead of her before she dies in the fall. She has eggs to lay, and the eggs must hatch out of their larvae, which must grow, pupate, and develop into adults.
The queen's first batch will develop into worker bees, small, sterile females who will enlarge the nest, forage, and tend the next generation of bees. She'll produce a second brood in late summer that includes males, called drones, and up to 100 fertile females who are candidates for next year's queen. Bumblebee colonies in temperate climates generally produce hundreds of successful queens. In the Arctic, only one queen per colony on average will survive the winter to renew the life cycle. For Sounds Wild, I'm Ann Sutton.
Sounds Wild is brought to you by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Good morning, it's 8:21. I'm Emily Files. Amanda Kiley, children's librarian at the Ketchikan Public Library, is here in the studio with me. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, good morning, Emily. Thanks for having me.
So you're here to talk about the summer reading program, is that right?
Yes, I am. So over in the children's library, we are presently gearing up for the busiest time of year, which is, of course, summer when all the kids are out of school. And one of our signature events that we do every year is we host a summer reading program. And our program this year has been many months in the making already, doing lots and lots of planning. And it starts in about a week and a half. So we're really excited for that.
Mm-hmm. So what does it involve?
Well, we're offering a lot of programs this year, so just planning the programs, planning the booklet, planning how the program works. We made some small changes this year from previous years, but it's similar. And I wanted to kind of first talk about, I guess, the purpose of the Summer Reading Club, why we actually do it. Because it really, other than just being fun, it does serve a couple of important purposes. And one of those is to prevent what we call the summer slide. So when children throughout the school year are developing skills, such as reading skills, if they get to... Once summer comes and they don't use those skills at all, when they start school in the fall, they have either fallen behind where they need to be. And what we try to do is to maintain those reading skills and possibly even increase those reading skills so they're ready for school in the fall. Mm-hmm. And the other purpose is really to create lifelong readers, to have kids associate reading with fun, to have it be a really enjoyable activity, and hopefully that will carry on throughout their youth into adulthood and they will become lifelong readers. And so that's why we offer lots of prizes, and I really encourage kids in the summertime to read whatever they want, like read what's fun, because while something like Garfield may not have a lot of literary value, it still is important if it gets like a reluctant reader to sit down with that book and enjoy it and really start associating reading with being a worthwhile activity, not seeing it as just an assignment or schoolwork or something like that. So that's a really important goal for me.
So what does the program involve? Is it something where the kids get a certain number of points for how much they read and then they get prizes?
Yeah. Well, basically what we have, it's 7 weeks. It starts June 7th and goes to July 26th. And for each week, there's a reading log. There are 7 reading logs, and they can finish them as quickly or as slowly as they want to. And so once they sign up, they get their first reading log and then just keep track of how long they've read. And then once that's filled out, they bring it into the library. They get a small incentive prize, and then they get one ticket into our weekly grand prize drawing. And so we're going to
have... What's the grand prize?
Well, we have 7 grand prizes, one every week. So we have some Lego sets, we have an iPod, we have a grand prize is the Kindle Fire.
Wow.
And I do have to give a shout out to the Friends of the Public Library, because they fund all of those prizes and a lot of the materials for the activities we do. So this really couldn't be possible without the Friends providing for those prizes.
How many kids are you hoping to have participate in the program?
Historically, we have at least 500 to 600 kids sign up.
Wow.
And, of course, not all of them finish all of their reading logs, but just getting them in the library is really the most important thing, having them come to the library, check out books, see what we do, attend a program, have fun. That's really our goal. So I would like to see, at least 500, hopefully up to 600.
Mm-hmm. Has the new location of the library impacted the involvement in the program?
Yes. Well, last summer, I don't know. I'm thinking that this summer we will see more people, because people are kind of getting used to the library being up here, and we're getting a lot of regulars who come in frequently, families who, spend time at the library in between swimming lessons or stop by after school, or it's kind of become incorporated into their family routine, I think. So, yeah.
But last summer, did you guys have some lower numbers because of the new location?
No, they were pretty similar. I mean, over the last 10 years, I would say they've been about the same. But yeah, this year I'm hoping to bump it up a little bit. And I'm trying new advertising and new ways to kind of increase participation by populations that maybe weren't participating before. So we'll see.
And what ages?
For the reading club, it is for any emerging readers up into 7th grade. And 7th grade, they can be either 12, 13-ish. But if they are 13, they're also eligible to join the teen reading club. And then we also have a preschool little listeners club, too, for those not yet reading. And they just keep track of, parents will write down the titles of the books that they have listened to. And after they get to a certain number, they bring it in and get a prize. And it's another way just to really start helping kids become lifelong readers is to really start early.
Do you remember when you were a kid if you participated in programs like this where you got prizes for reading?
You know, I don't think I actually participated in reading clubs, but I was a library rat. I spent a lot of time at the library growing up.
Yeah. Yes. I remember when I was a kid, we had a program at our public library that gave prizes for reading.
Yeah.
Got points. It was
yeah.
fun. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else to add?
A couple of things. I just wanted to let people know some of the activities we have going on this summer, because like I said, we're doing a lot more than we have in the past. We're offering two school-aged kid activities every week and two story crafts for preschoolers every single week. And so for the school-aged kids, in June, we're going to host a fort, building forts at the library, which I'm really excited about. You just come in and it's going to be after hours and the lights will be off and you bring your sheets and blankets and pillows and your favorite book and just build forts. We're doing giant bubble blowers, art robots, and animal track casting, and showing a couple of movies. So there's lots going on, and a lot of opportunities for families to come in, mm-hmm. for kids of all ages to come in. And all of our activities are free. Some of them are limited just by the amount of materials we have. We can only have, you know, up to 20 kids per activity, but anybody is welcome. And then with our preschool story crafts, historically we've only offered those on Thursdays, but now we're going to start doing them on Thursdays and Fridays, just because Thursdays have been really crazy with, like, we'll get up to, you know, 60 or 70 people at a story time on Thursday. And so mm-hmm. we're going to kind of hopefully spread those people out between Thursday and Friday.
Yeah.
And what else? Oh, the Stevens puppets. That was the last thing. We have the Stevens puppets, a marionette troupe. They're coming on Thursday, and they're doing two performances at 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock.
Fun.
It is. Well, I think it's so cool because, you know, a lot of kids in Ketchikan just, they may not know what a marionette is or how that works, or have never been to a large, you know, produced puppet show. So mm-hmm. I think it's a really cool opportunity. You do need tickets, but because space is limited, but they are free. And I think there's still room left for the 6 p.m. show.
And when is that?
It's this Thursday, 2 days from now.
Okay.
And you can come over to the library and pick up those free tickets.
All right. Thanks so much, Amanda.
Thank you for having me, Emily.
And for more information, should people just give the library a call?
Yeah, just call the library, 225-3331.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Good morning, it's 8:32. I'm Emily Files, and Jessica Mills Clark is in the studio with me from the Association for Education of Young Children. She's going to tell us about a shortage of childcare options in Ketchikan and what you guys are planning on doing about that, right?
That's right. Thanks for inviting me over this morning. I appreciate it. So basically the situation is, this is true for all of southern southeast Alaska, that there's just a really significant shortage of child care slots available. And the numbers that I have available right now are for Ketchikan, but this is true for Juneau and all the way south. Mm. So just to give you an example, we have 868 children under the age of four in Ketchikan right now, but only 186 slots are available.
Say those numbers again.
Well, it's a ratio of 1 to 5. So for each child under the age of four, for each child care slot. There you go. I was going to do it backwards. But for each child care slot, there are 5 children who need that slot.
And those child care slots are daycare, preschool?
It's mostly child care, licensed child care.
Okay.
So the cutoff is like through age 4, because then when children get to be about 5, they go to school.
Okay.
So this is
before preschool child care.
Yeah. Okay. And there are good preschool options available in this town. But most of the preschool options are only a half day. Mm-hmm. And if you're a working parent, you need full day coverage. Yeah. So
why is there this huge shortage?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I think it's a persistent problem in our area, but this is really kind of the worst it's been in over a decade. And I know some of the long-term answers are related to the economy and the pay and the turnover and things like that for this industry. Mm. And maybe, you know, just the difficulty of getting a startup small business if you're a family child care. So there are a lot of options for support for people who are looking to start a child care or who have a child care center. And we have a lot of really good licensed child care options in Ketchikan right now. They're, you know, high quality, good providers. We just need more. Hmm. And so we're thinking that the national average is about 64% of parents who have children under preschool age are working. But in our area, it's actually higher because of the cost of living.
Oh, what's the percentage in this area?
It's about 74%.
So 74% of families have, the parents in the household are working.
If they have children under the age of four.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a rough estimate. So those numbers that I just gave you, like 868 children, you know, the majority of those children actually do need care.
So what are some options that parents who are working who can't find a slot for their children in a daycare center or something, what do they do?
That is a great question. So we're going to have a meeting this Thursday night to talk about some creative solutions for that. So this Thursday, that's May 29th, from 5:30 to 7, we're just going to have a community conversation about some creative solutions to this. The meeting's going to be at the Community Connections Building, which is on Stedman. It's, you guys know where it is. It's 731 Stedman Street. So what we're hoping to do is to get some parents who need care, but we're also hoping to get some employers to come to this meeting as well, and maybe some child care providers, because they can provide a network of support for people who are maybe thinking about getting started, or maybe there's probably a lot of relatives out there who are providing care for, you know, grandchildren or nieces or nephews or somebody like that. There's a lot of sort of casual options that people are participating in, I would imagine. And so those folks could come and see, what support is out there.
So do you have any ideas of potential solutions that you all are going to be talking about?
Well, there are some good solutions as far as putting together a network of people who are doing this casually and giving them the support that they might need to open up a child care business of their own in order to accept more children. There's some options as far as some, what do you call it, flexible time, you know, so parents can kind of share the responsibility and kind of do it that way. There are, you know, some longer term solutions that might be available are looking at the child care wages and the turnover and things that we as a community can do to support child care providers. There's a CDA out there, the certificate or the child care, I'm getting all confused now. Child Development Associate is a certificate that you can earn as a child care provider that says, I have the education and training to do this. And some other communities have been pretty successful in putting together a program that will help people, child care providers, obtain this this certificate. And then, you know, they provide higher quality child care because they have this education behind them, and it reduces the turnover, and it actually ends up making child care you know, a better business option for people, because the turnover rate goes down, and most of all, children have consistent care providers, which is really important for quality care.
So when there's a shortage of child care options, is there a risk that children will be put into unsafe situations with maybe uncertified caregivers? Or
I would say that there is, because you know, parents need to work, and they just feel that pressure to, you know, economic pressures to go to work. So there might be some less than optimal solutions that people come up with, or you know, we just want to really focus on the quality care for children in this area and, you know, all communities.
Has your group had a brainstorming meeting like this before?
Not since I've been working here in Ketchikan, but they did just have a similar meeting in Juneau, because Juneau has a similar issue to that. And so they came up with some ideas and some networks, and we're going to use some of their ideas for our area, but also, you know, see what works for Ketchikan. So I've been doing this for about 3 years. So in the last 3 years, we haven't done something like that.
Okay, well, tell us again the information for that meeting.
Sure, thanks. So come to the meeting Thursday, May 29th from 5:30 to 7 at the Community Connections Building. We're going to talk about some creative solutions to the child care issue in this area.
Yeah. All right. Anything else to add about that?
No, but thank you very much for letting me come in this morning.
Thank you for bringing this problem to our attention. Okay. I hope that you guys come up with some good solutions.
Oh, thanks.
Half of all students who get accepted to college are told that, in spite of being accepted, they are not ready, at least not in one or more subjects, like math. So they're sent to remedial class.
And then thousands of them drop out. And that is costing states and students an estimated $3 billion a year.
Which is why some states are working to reform a broken remedial system. From Colorado Public Radio, Jenny Brundine reports.
Imagine that day you open the letter and you've been accepted into college.
but you're also told you're borderline in math and have to sign up for remedial classes at the community college across town for no credit.
I think part of it's just stigma.
Jessica Parker coordinates writing at Metropolitan State University in Denver.
It's demoralizing to get accepted to the university, and then we say, yeah, great, you're one of our students, but not really right now.
Metro is trying to erase that stigma and try something new. It's the first university to take advantage of a new Colorado law that allows colleges and universities to keep those borderline students on their campuses. But they're not just going straight into regular classes. Colleges are offering new courses that give these students the boost they need to succeed and get credit, too.
Beautiful, 4 out of 5. So what does that mean about the probability of getting a not fair coin?
Courses like this required study group. It takes place in a small classroom, just 12 students. Together, they help each other figure out problems, and if they get stuck...
Kelly, will you check this?
Instructor Kelly Zolnikoff is there to help.
735, it's different from 375.
After 1 year of the program, more students in these groups pass their core math class than those who aren't. And in writing, almost 90% of borderline students in similar study groups pass the core English class. That's compared to only about 70% of regular students. Metro's Jessica Parker says these restructured classes are working.
You're learning the same things that all of our first-year writing students are learning, but we're giving you some extra opportunities for interaction with your peers and your professors.
Opportunities include Roger Green's Stretch class. It's the regular freshman writing class, but is stretched over 2 semesters instead of just 1.
I can give them assignments that would, in second semester, have alienated them. The first 2 weeks of class, they would have dropped class. They would have said, this is not for me. I don't belong here.
Audrey Rankle's entrance exam for writing indicated she didn't belong. But the new law gave her the green light to enroll in freshman English based on 1 condition. She also has to take a writing lab once a week. Today, she's giving a grammar presentation.
Coordinating or subordinating?
To test her fellow students' knowledge, she gives them a pop quiz. Suddenly, when a student gives the right answer, Michael runs over to high-five him.
Yeah!
I'm so happy right now. I'm always, like, telling my boyfriend, this is what I learned in school today. And he's like, okay. Always trying to pass the knowledge along that I learned.
Rankle is excited about grammar, about learning something new, and about helping others with their writing. This is her 4th try at college. After years of struggling, the writing lab has given her skills to better understand texts in her other classes, classes for which she's now getting college credit. Since the law went into effect, 1,700 students like her across campus are also on the path now to a cap and gown. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundin in Denver.
And let's hear more about the testing that begins well before students are even thinking about applying for college. This is actually testing season in plenty of grade schools around the country, and many states are testing new standards called the Common Core. California is one of them. Common Core has come under fire from some parents and educators who complain the tests can be confusing. NPR's education team wondered what children think of it, and they sent Youth Radio's Miles Best to an elementary school in the San Francisco Bay Area.
I graduated high school in 2012. So I missed out on the Common Core. But when I went to Meadow Homes Elementary, I was curious. What's all the hype about? Passing the play structures and the drawings on the wall, I got nostalgic for grammar school. Then I met Principal Mary Louise Newling and got a reality check.
I find the math to be eye-opening. I guess I was shocked. I think all of my teachers were taken aback when we actually attempted the test.
Newling likes the Common Core, but admits it's a big transition. The standards require students to explain their work in writing, even in math. That's complicated when 80% of her school is English language learners. Just when I thought I couldn't be more intimidated by the Common Core, I met the students, a bunch of bubbly 4th graders. Do you guys know what the Common Core is?
Yes.
Is it hard?
No.
No.
Sometimes.
These kids weren't scared at all by the Common Core. In fact, they wanted to spend the whole afternoon doing math problems with me, showing me strategies. First, the box method for multiplication.
I like this way because you can understand it more than the way it's just easier because you get to break it up.
Savannah Burr starts scribbling on my notebook with the kids gathered around. Here's the problem, 8 times 14.
We draw a box, and for a two-digit number, you can break it up. So 8 times 14. 14 is really 10 plus 4.
It's hard to explain for radio, but try breaking down a multiplication problem into two simpler problems. Why do 8 times 14 when you can do 8 times 10 and 8 times 4 and add the two products?
And so you can just add 80 plus 32, you get 112.
Oh, I get it. Well, this is how I was taught to do it, and it's clearly not as cool as this. So 14 times 8, right? So what's 8 times 4? 32? Right? They didn't like my way at all. The division was even harder than the multiplication. And again, these fourth graders used a method I'd never heard of, the hangman method. It's also hard to explain, but not hard to get an answer from Gabriella Morris.
24 remainder 4 is the answer.
Well, your teacher just gave me the thumbs up, so you got it right. I'm still confused. So is it hard, like, when you guys take homework home and you try to have your parents help you?
No.
Why?
Because it's not, like, really that hard for me. So I don't really need help from my mom and dad.
That was Paulina Munoz. I still wasn't convinced. Why were these kids so excited about this approach to math that feels like a lot more work? I asked their fourth grade teacher, Jessica Bierbaum.
They're stuck at first, and sometimes they're stuck at first with describing. We've gone away again from A, B, C, or D being the right answer, or teaching an algorithm to approach a mathematical issue. So we have to get away from that easy answer thing.
10 fourth graders in Concord, California don't speak for everyone. And that one kid who didn't say much, she might hate the Common Core. But as many adults across the country struggle with the new standards, these kids seem surprisingly eager and willing to embrace something new. For NPR News, I'm Miles Best. You guys have taught me something.
Yes, and you're older than us.
I'm proud. I like to learn. This is fun.
Yeah. Math power.
Math power, just what you want to hear from a kid. That story was produced by Youth Radio. This is NPR News.
Support for KRBD is provided by Timber and Marine Supply, offering steel chainsaws and trimmers, along with service, parts, and accessories. Timber and Marine Supply, open 6 days a week, 225-6644, located next to Madison Lumber and Hardware on Tongass Avenue.
Support comes from BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 27th of May, 2014. It's the birthday of John Cheever, born Quincy, Massachusetts, 1912, wrote for more than 50 years, published more than 200 short stories. His collection of stories published in 1978 became one of the few collections of short stories ever to make the New York Times bestseller list. John Cheever, who said, "For me, a page of good prose is where one hears the rain and the noise of battle. It has the power to give grief or universality that lends it a youthful beauty." He said the writer's task is to evoke the perfumes of life, seawater, the smoke of burning hemlock, and the breasts of women. The Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco opened to the public on this day. In 1937, cantilevered suspension bridge, 8,981 feet long. The architects were Joseph Strauss, Charles Alton Ellis, Irving Morrow. For this day, 200,000 people crossed the bridge. Some of them roller skated. A woman used stilts. Several people walked backwards. Many people tap danced the entire way. There were marching bands and beauty queens and speeches. Foghorn sounded, people played harmonicas. It's the birthday of Frans Cornelis Donders, the Dutch physician who pioneered ophthalmology, born in Tilburg, 1818. The research of Donders led to major advances in the study of astigmatism, nearsightedness, farsightedness. He was among the first to experiment with corrective lenses to improve vision. And he was responsible for the invention of the ophthalmotonometer, a device used to test the tension of the eyeball for signs of glaucoma. It's the birthday of the woman who wrote, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on." Julia Ward Howe, born New York City in 1819. It's the birthday of Rachel Carson, born 1907 in Pennsylvania, wrote a best-selling book about the dangers of pesticides. Silent Spring came out in 1962, one of the most influential books in the environmental movement. It's the birthday of detective novelist Tony Hillerman, Sacred Heart, Oklahoma, 1925, author of novels about the Navajo detective Joe Leaphorn. It's the birthday of the poet Linda Paston, born New York City, 1932, who said, "I often write poems in my head.